Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Enhancing Performance in Contract conference call. All lines are in an interactive mode, and we ask that you please refrain from placing your phones on hold. If you need to mute your line and do not have a self-muting feature on your phone, at the conclusion of my opening remarks, you may now press star, then 6 on your touch-tone telephone. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star, then 0. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. Now, and I'd like to introduce your host for today's conference, Ms. Mary O'Brien. Ms. O'Brien, you may begin.
Thank you. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hello. This is Mary O'Brien, and on behalf of the National Child Welfare Resource Center for Organizational Improvement, I want to welcome everyone to today's call on Enhancing Performance in Contracts, Outcomes and Monitoring. Today we are here to talk about building outcomes into contracts and monitoring performance and how to do it successfully. I'm really pleased that we have with us today Erwin McEwen, who is Deputy Director of Monitoring and Quality Assurance for the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services. And he's recently been promoted, he tells me, to Acting Director of the Department. So we're honored to have him, as I really think he is one of the best people working in this field and thinking about this topic in the country today. I thought it would make sense in this call to focus on Illinois, as this state has a lot of experience and has learned a couple of lessons that I think really apply to a lot of places around the country and that are valuable for the rest of us to hear and learn from. One of the lessons they've learned is that when you make changes in contract language that you want to lead to improvements in performance, you need to, as Mr. McEwen says, set the stage for performance. This means there are other things that the public agency needs to do, and these start with working collaboratively with providers to identify barriers to performance, and then as the public agency taking an active role in addressing these barriers to set the stage for improved performance. Things like the involvement of and understanding of other systems, such as the courts, of what you're trying to achieve, the service array that currently exists, and what new services need to be developed to meet needs. Those are the kinds of things that the public agency needs to be actively involved in to set the stage for performance. Another lesson I think that they've learned is that designing financing incentives is challenging. States have found it difficult to design a mix of financial incentives that work. I, at the Resource Center for Organizational Improvement, have put together a packet of information for states that contact us about performance-based contracting. I go over 5 approaches and give examples with websites and resources. One approach is in this packet is to build outcomes into contracts and monitor those outcomes without really financial incentives. Kansas and how their contracts are structured today is an example of that. And I think there are some folks from Kansas on the line who we hope to hear from them a bit, and we hope to hear from them a bit later. The other 4 approaches that I discuss in this packet all involve changing the financing of contracts in some way to promote outcomes. The second approach is building performance-based payments into contracts. The third that agencies have had more success with is building some outcomes-focused payments into contracts for adoption services. Another example, the 4th, is case rates where agencies blend funds across systems to move high-end kids back into communities under, like, systems of care kind of models, and places have had some success with that approach. The 5th approach is the approach used by Illinois and by Philadelphia, which I call controlling the caseload. Mr. McEwen will explain it to you all better than I, but it's the idea of paying contractors for a fixed caseload and giving them a certain number of kids with the expectation that they move a percentage of those kids to permanency. What we're going to hear about today is the interesting story about how these performance-based contracts in Illinois have evolved from the first phase, where there were financial incentives that I just described around permanency, to realizing that they were not performing well in other areas around safety and well-being, and they've moved to using a broader set of performance requirements. So we'll hear from Mr. McEwen about the Illinois experience, and as he's talking, we'll try to pause and take some questions. Then what I want to do is give other states on the line a chance to share their experience with building outcomes into contracts and monitoring so we can learn from one another. If you have anything that you've done that's worked, I hope that you'll share it. Because I think a lot of states are challenged by this undertaking. Then we'll have some time for questions and discussions, and we'll plan to end by 4 o'clock.
There and then.
So before we start, there's a couple of other logistical things I want to mention. First of all, if you're talking, could you just put your phone on mute, okay? Because the lines are all open and interactive, so we can hear your discussions. That's one thing. Handouts for this call were attached to the email you received with the phone number to use for this call. I want to tell you that these handouts are also available on our website, and I'm going to give you that link. In fact, we've decided that from now on, starting with our spring teleconference calls, we will email the link and direct everyone to the website for handouts. The website is www.n as in national, r as in resource, c as in center, o as in organizational, and I as in improvement.org. So we've got www.nrcoi.org. That website is also on one of the handouts that you got in your email, which is called Agenda and Contact Information. The website is on that. The handouts that we provided you today are that handout with the agenda and the contact information, and then three other pieces. There's a piece that Mr. McEwen put together called Illinois Performance-Based Contracts, which is an overview that he's written about the first phase of performance-based contracts and what they've done in the second phase. There's a file that has some contract language from Illinois, and then there's an Excel file which has some of the statewide results showing performance on the measures, this more comprehensive set of measures over the first year. So those are the handouts that you have as sort of background for today's call. I will remind you again that the lines are open and interactive, so you can speak up at any time, but put your phone on mute if you've got background noise going on. We want to get a sense before we start of who is on the line. We have representatives from 29 states who registered for the call today and a number of ACF regional offices. It's always a bit chaotic, but I like to hear voices out there so we don't feel like we're speaking into the void. So I just want to get a sense of who's out there. So you could speak up and tell us. I'm thinking, first of all, about ACF regional offices. Are there some ACF regional offices out there? You could speak up and just identify yourselves.
Region 7's on.
Hi, Region 7.
Hi.
Okay. Now, how about some states out there on the line? Can you just speak up and identify yourself?
This is Kansas.
Hi, Kansas. Hi.
Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Ohio.
Yeah.
Tennessee.
Great.
Nebraska.
Washington.
Yeah.
Maine.
Kentucky.
Michigan.
Oh, great.
Alaska.
Great.
Hawaii is here.
Okay.
Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
D.C.
Anna.
Oh, great.
Colorado.
Great.
West Virginia.
Okay.
Florida,
great.
New Hampshire.
Great. Okay, welcome, everyone. That's really wonderful. It's great to hear your voices, and we hope we'll be able to have a discussion, and feel free to ask questions. Thanks very much. Okay, great. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. McEwen to hear from him about their experience in Illinois.
Thank you, Mary.
Great.
I'm going to start out at the beginning of this story and talk about what triggered the motivation to move into performance-based contracting. From 1988 to like 1996 or 97, Illinois saw its caseloads more than triple. It went from like 12,000, 13,000 kids in care to a high of about 52,000 kids in care. And it was really taxing the system in Illinois. Caseworkers were overburdened. Things just seemed to be gridlocked with all of these kids in care. I'm not going to get into a whole discussion about what was driving those issues. but the fact that it's set up that way. And the notion of how do you start to right-size a system and get the kids down to a significant number that is more manageable. And so in Illinois, what we did was we started to look at how do you set the stage and how do you start to get a system ready for this performance, you know, with the goal in mind of reducing the number of the kids in care. And in Illinois at that time, we had a lot of kids who had been in foster home 5, 6, 7 years. The likelihood of them returning home wasn't there. Some of the parental rights had been terminated and the adoptions hadn't been finalized. Just a lot of that type of thing. So one of the first things that we had to do is to look at the entire system and design ways of setting the stage. And so the first thing to do was to do a front-end redesign. And what the front-end redesign was about was it looking at how kids came into the system. And what we saw was a large number of kids coming into the system who were being cared for by relatives. Some of those kids had been with relatives for a long time. And the only reason they were coming into the system was financial support or other services. And so the notion of how you examine whether a kid was abused, neglected, or abandoned as it related to them being provided care by relatives was one of the ways of redesigning the front end to control the front door to make sure the kids who came into the system were really, truly abused and neglected and not just need of other services because they were being cared for by a relative. And the other part to that also was you still had to have a way of providing those relatives with some short-term support to address those critical needs that caused them to call the hotline in the first place. So the front-end redesign was kind of really about really doing an examination of that. And then the second part to the front-end redesign was the use of the child endangerment risk assessment protocol that really helped to shape the thinking of investigators in making the determination of when to pull a kid into placement and into care, when to provide intact family services, or whether or not even if it was an indicated situation that the family may not have needed any services, but because the parental protection capacities were available in the home. The second thing to set the stage came from our legislators. And in 1997, Illinois General Assembly passed legislation that required us to cut down the permanency planning timelines and all of those other issues. It pretty much mirrored the Adoptions and Safe Family Act. It was just a little ahead of that act. And the pressure on the legislators to move these kids out and to change law and to change the notion of having a long-term foster care goal and all of those issues put pressure on the system to move these kids along. It wasn't acceptable that they could sit in a foster home and have parental rights terminated and not be moving toward adoption. One of the third things around setting the stage was the restructuring of the public-private relationship. Previously in Illinois, we had had one DCFS worker assigned to every case. In those cases that were under privatization, we had a DCFS worker assigned to those cases as well, even though the private agency caseworker was doing most of the work, really all of the work. And so one thing was to change how we looked at that relationship with our private providers. And Illinois has a very rich history with private agencies. We've got a large number of institutional child welfare agencies that have been in existence for 100 years. And so we have a real rich resource in that area. And a lot of them predate the department in providing child welfare services. We just celebrated our 40th year anniversary a few years ago to give you some context. And so restructuring that relationship to give the private agencies full case management responsibility and free up a lot of the DCFS workforce that was really duplicated efforts into doing other things, and to develop a system where each agency was assigned a monitor as opposed to having every individual case assigned a monitor. So the restructuring of the public-private relationships into an area where one person would monitor the agency, or maybe two people if it was a very large agency. And it helped because where you might have had multiple workers monitoring each case, we were now able to get a more complete picture of the agency because one person was monitoring the agency. Then the issue of the private provider buy-in. It was real critical in Illinois with having so much of the work privatized historically that the private agencies had to buy into the need for performance-based contracting. And how you presented that argument or the need for it to them really, really relied on the availability of reliable and verifiable data. And it was always ongoing debates between the public sector and the private sector about whether or not the data that DCFS had was reliable. You know, a lot of times there were issues around payment issues, whether or not this kid was in your care or not in your care. There were issues around whether the guardianship was there or not the guardianship there when you would call in for consent for different issues. And so there was evidence that there was some issues with DCFS data. Even though it could be rectified, the number of situations required us to say that we needed to have more reliable and more verifiable data. So as a result, we wound up using the Chapin Hall data because it was research data and they went through a process of trying to ensure its quality that the private sector and DCFS settled on that being the data that we would use for performance measures. The other thing was getting the agreement that as we reduce the number of kids in care, that the department would reinvest some of the savings back into providing higher quality care. Because everybody agreed that the system was taxed and it was oversized caseloads and those sort of things. So as we reinvested back into the system, we would reinvest in quality care. And some of those reinvestments were, we originally started out with 25-to-1 caseloads. We went down to 22-to-1 caseloads, 18-to-1 caseloads, and we're currently at 15-to-1. We also put into place a permanency worker for each team. So a team with 7 workers and a supervisor, we added another person to those teams to work on the adoption issues. We put foster care recruitment dollars into those contracts as a reinvestment as the number of foster homes started to decline as foster parents adopted or took guardianship of these kids and discontinued taking in new foster kids. And those are some examples of the types of reinvestment. And then it was the notion of realignment of contract incentives. The structure was a fee-for-service structure where for a day of care, you got a day's pay per diem for that child. And so it wasn't an incentive to move kids out and reduce your caseloads because you were reducing your funding. And it also impacted your ability to plan. So if you had some large number of kids fall off your caseload for any given reason, it would impact your budget going forward. And so the contracts were realigned by designing a system that we purchased a caseload level at the beginning based on 25-to-1. So if you had 100 cases, we purchased the services of 4 caseworkers, and we tied the administrative rate to that for all the other things that it took to support that one caseworker, kind of a bottom-up approach. And we contracted at the beginning of the year, and the agency's guaranteed to move 25% out of care, and we guaranteed that we would refer as intake 25 cases so that at any given time in the year, depending on how quickly an agency reached those permanency goals, exit goals, they would have fewer or more cases based on how we sent the intake. And so the average would always be 100, and if they moved 25 kids to permanency and they got 25 intakes, at the end of the year they would be at 100. But there's also incentives, because if an agency was to move more than the 25 kids out of care, they would still be receiving 25 intakes, but they would finish the year at less than 100 children. And they would still be paid for 100 children. But there's also disincentives because if they achieved less than the performance permanency rate of, say, 15 children against that 100, they would finish the year with 110 kids, but they would still only be paid for 100 kids. So as a result, they had a serious competitive disadvantage when you got some agencies with smaller caseloads and some agencies with larger caseloads, and they accumulated. And so the incentives were built in for kids to be moved out of care. And as a result, we saw historic declines between 1997, really starting around 1999, up until current, that saw our caseload plummet from 52,000 kids to our current caseload level of about 16,600 kids. At the very beginning of this process, looking at other states who had similar populations, the idea was to try to right-size the system. And actually, in the beginning of what we thought was a right-size system, we reached those numbers and exceeded those numbers. But what we saw was some unintended negative consequences that occurred because of those efforts. Some of those things were the aging of the population, that a lot of times we were able to move younger children and older children remained in care. So we saw the age of our population go from an average of about 40% over 13, and it used to be only about 13% over 13. Some of the other things is that the services that kids who were aging out of the system and their readiness for independence were at question. Incentives that appeared to favor adoption and guardianship over family reunification. Some of those were the unintended negative consequences. And so as we looked and having achieved our goals of right-siding the system, new things came on the scene, new challenges that we needed to deal with. And, of course, those unintended consequences was one set of new challenges, but there was also the Child and Family Services Review. And so we had to figure out ways to redefine performance outcomes and set the stage for these new performance outcomes. And one of the things that we looked at was Director Samuels had did a task force, a governor's task force, where he looked at child welfare prior to coming on board as the director. And right immediately after that, we were also going through the CFSR process, the Child and Family Services Review. And the task force findings and the Child and Family Services Review findings echoed each other. And so we looked at some of the areas needing improvement, and we looked at those areas that we thought performance-based contracting could impact. So one of the areas was permanency outcomes, P1. And we thought we can use things in performance-based contract to address stability of foster care placement, permanency goals for the children, reunification, guardianship, appointment and placement with relatives, and adoption. We thought we could intersect permanency outcome 2, P2, with visitation with parents and siblings, relationships of children in care with parents, and well-being 1, with the needs and services of child, parents, and foster parents, child and family involvement in case planning, worker visits with child, and worker visits with parents. And so those were some of the areas of need and improvement that we saw we can make an immediate impact with performance-based contracting. So some of the things that we had to do to set the stage for the second phase of performance-based contracting is we designed an integrated assessment. The integrated assessment is really a front-end assessment that tries to do a quality assessment of the family within the first 60 days across all domains and age-appropriate issues the family may have. So if you have a children in the family who was 0 to 3, we want to make sure a 0 to 3 evaluation is done in the first 60 days. Really less than that, but those were the timelines. That if it was a kid in middle school, that you had the appropriate assessment done on that kid educationally. Any mental health issues or any other needs that were indicated, you did the assessments to get that information, domestic violence, drug and alcohol, and you completed all of the interviews with all of the family members within that first 60 days and all of those other contacts. 60 days is when everything, the entire process would have to be completed. Most of the interviewing and quality assessment piece took place within the first 20 days. And the engagement of the parents in all of those areas. We also lowered the caseloads to 15-1 in FY05, and this is the same year that took a pretty serious hit to our budget and really saw the need to do that. and lower the caseloads again. We did a new reunification concurrent planning model. We're still working on that model. It's almost about to roll out. We did a redesign of independent living and transitional living services. We used to see that there was no clear definition between the two. Some practice areas were not aligned. For example, everybody had in their program plan 24-hour supervision, but that could have meant on-site staff 24 hours. It could have meant that they had a cell phone that they can call 24 hours. It could have meant that they could pay somebody 24 hours on an on-call system. So we had to realign and define and strengthen the distinctions between independent living, transitional living, and what were the expected required services. And then there was the child and youth investment team that we developed, because having kids age out of the system and having kids growing older as our system grew older, we needed to have an effective way to identify higher needs of care for these kids and access those higher levels of care for those kids. And as kids age in the system, considerable proportion of them needs higher levels of care. And so we had to have a way of evaluating those, identifying those needs, and moving those kids to those higher levels of care. And that was our Child and Youth Investment Team. And we called it SAID as an acronym. And then our system of care was focused on placement stabilization, so that as you have these older kids and other problems arise in the foster home, we needed to have an emergency response system to help stabilize those placements and give the foster parents their support, the support they needed as the population started to age. So those were some of the things we did to set the stage for the new performance outcomes. A better description of all of these initiatives, these are all cross-cutting initiatives from our Child and Family Services Review Program Improvement Plan, and I'm pretty sure that plan is online on our DCFS site, and you can get a more detailed narrative description of all of those cross-cutting initiatives. And then in redefining performance outcomes, we looked at the over-reliance of permanency as a measure for performance. And we reduced from 80%, originally 100%, then down to 80% permanency, and then down to 40%. When we reduced from 80%, the two measures we only looked at were stability and permanency. And so we looked at some research and some indicators that said that systems should be able to focus on 5 to 8 goals, overarching goals, that you can focus in and then spread them around. I would have to caution you guys that some of our literature reviews and some of the things we looked at also indicated that it was not a good idea to use process measures as performance indicators, and that you were better to use those solid outcome measures like a permanency, a completed adoption, or like stability. And so in that area, we struggled a little bit, but to try to have a good mix of both process measures and performance, pure outcome measures, and we avoided the slippery slope of having efforts. And a lot of times that comes up because agencies would complain that, you know, they made the effort and didn't get the result, but why should they not get credit for that effort? So I saw it as a three-tiered slope is the best way I can describe it, is that at the top and plateau and the solid ground is on a solid outcome that's measurable, like adoption and permanency. And as you start to have process measures like the amount of contact, so you're measuring the amount of contact, but what's difficult is to measure the quality of that contact. And then the even slipperier slope is where you start to count efforts, where you can look at a case record and see attempted visits and give people credit for attempted visits. And so that's just an example of that slope of pure outcome, a process outcome measure, and an effort measure. And so we looked at it and we divided those redefined performance outcomes into permanency, and we expanded permanency to include other positive outcomes at 40% of the performance. Stability, we counted as 20% of the new performance goals, Engagement, we broke down into three areas: client contact, which got 50%, 15%, child and family team meetings, which got 5%, and then integrated assessment compliance. We did not give a performance to that, but we used it as a quality assurance tool to see how our integrated assessment process was rolling out and working, because it was a very new process. And then we used discharge outcomes as 5% of the goal and educational outcomes as 15% of the goal. I have to also add another thing in here. In our first year, we tried to develop an educational dashboard passport that we thought we could pull educational data from the many different sources and do a ranking, and we were unable to do that. And so pretty much in the first year, everybody got 15% credit for education if they met certain goals for making the visits to the school. But what we have done now is develop educational protocols to assess that, and we got a better way of measuring that. Now, going back, we developed protocols, case record review, data collection instruments to go back and look at engagement around client contact, child and family team meetings, discharge outcomes in those areas. We used the AFGARS data for the stability measure and defined it exactly as the federal government was defining it. And permanency, we continue to use the same Chapin Hall data that we've always used for the performance contracting around permanency outcomes. Okay? Starting with the 40% permanency and other outcomes. The way we defined that was we said reunification cases, adoption cases, kids who graduated from high school before exiting the foster care system or stepping up to independent living or transitional living, and extra credit for obtaining adoptions, reunifications, and guardianships on older kids to try to get at some of those things. And you divided that by the total caseload. And that's how we came up with the permanency and other positive outcome performance. Some of the extra credit areas that I talked about was permanency reached for children over the age of 14, reunifications completed within 12 months of entry into care, adoptions within 24 months of entry to care. Those came directly out of our child and family service review PIP goals. And each qualifying case counts as twice rather than one in the rated calculation. And what that did was it helped agencies to, because everybody was used to getting adoptions and performance, and the system was averaging about 28%, I think, at that time around permanency performance, these other areas helped to divide agencies out. And agencies that could accomplish these more stringent things got extra credit and would outperform agencies that were just able to do the usual permanency, because we've been into that permanency as a performance measure for about 10 years now. The program improvement plan, our PIP initiatives that helped us to look at these outcomes for permanency was lower caseloads, integrated assessment, our new reunification concurrent planning model, and our transitional living and independent living. Our next one was placement stabilities, and we just took placement and we gave it a 20%. The allocation of the points were for the placement stability based on a federal measure that just looked at the last 12 months and that sort of thing. So stability was real straightforward and probably the easiest one to measure because we're already doing it for the feds. Some of the program plan initiatives that we looked at around the stability was our system of care, you know, which was an emergency response system, and then a crisis intervention system for stabilization. Our child and youth investment team that tried to assess how we move kids to higher levels of care and also assessing service need to stabilize care. Our integrated assessment, as well as our new reunification and concurrent planning model. All of those program improvement plan initiatives we thought impacted stability. The next one was engagement at 15%, and the allocation of points for this was based on looking at our policy and procedure and identifying all the required contacts. So parent-child visits required once a week, So they had to achieve 13 and a quarter, just counting the number of weeks. Parent worker visits, which were required once a month, and so they had to have three of those in a quarter. And parent foster parent worker visits, which are once a month, and they had to have three of those in a quarter. And child worker visits, which are once a month, and they'd have to have three of those in a quarter. And they could not, they had to have distinct separate functions for these. So as an example, a worker couldn't record a parent worker visit because they monitored a parent-child visit, because they couldn't have been engaging that parent in service if that parent was visiting with their child. They couldn't be engaging it in case planning or those other issues. And if they was doing that, doing a parent-child visit, then they were taken away from the child's interaction with the parent. And so we made sure that the credit for those are separate, distinct functions. They can't all be done at one time. So I pick the kid up at the foster home. That's my parent, foster parent worker visit. I supervise the visit with the parent and child, so I get credit for that. And since the parent was there, I get my parent worker contact at the same time. No. They had to be separate, divided functions. And that was 15%. And, again, as extra credit to hone in on the child and family services things we needed to address, they got, for every child and parent visit over 13 in that quarter, they got extra credit. For each visit supervised by the caseworker, because sometimes a case aide may supervise the visit, sometimes they had contracted visitation services, and we wanted to encourage the caseworker, the assigned direct service worker, to do as many supervise as many of these as possible, so they'll know more about the parent-child relationship. For each parent-worker visit that occurred in the parent's home, a lot of times these workers, the parents always are coming to the office for the visit, this, that, and other. We wanted to encourage them to get out into the field and into the homes of these parents, because you can start to really get a better assessment and get these kids home quicker, if that's possible, by being in that parent home. For each parent worker visit with the non-custodial parent, this was to address the issue that we did a poor job of engaging non-custodial parents in services and a poor job of engaging them in planning for services. So we said for each parent worker visit with the non-custodial parent, and for each parent-child visit with the non-custodial parent, they got extra credit in the contact engagement. For the program improvement plan initiatives that associated with this areas were lower caseload and integrated assessment. And then the engagement, two, was around child and family team meetings. And that's a requirement that they have a child and family team meeting every quarter. There was a debate around this issue because some train of thought was that if you have in the administrative case review every 6 months, that could serve as this. And what we really settled on, with no scientific or anything like that, what we settled on was the notion that administrative case reviews was to review the plan, the past plan, and review the plan going forward for quality. It was a quality assurance type review. But the actual engagement in the development of those plans should take place in the child and family team meeting. And so we required that they be had every 90 days according to DCFS's existing policy, and we also looked at who were the required participants according to DCFS policy. And we gave that 5%. And then the last discharge, the last goal was discharge outcomes. And this is kind of an expansion of the notion of permanency, because we could see that kids left these performance contracts to permanency, adoption, and reunification, but other kids left these contracts for other reasons. And so if a kid stepped up to group care or stepped up to spec care, agencies were penalized. And one of the unintended negative consequences was that it suppressed the population moving to those high levels of services even when they needed them. And it increased the number of homes, a number of placement settings that a child had. And what we saw from one report, I'm calling these numbers off the top of my head, but in one report we saw that in 96, 97, prior to performance-based contracting, I think it was like an average of 3 placement settings a kid had before they stepped up to a higher level of care. And in 2003 and 2004, we saw kids having 10 placement settings before they stepped up to a higher level of care. And so discharge outcomes measurements looked at agency performance, looked at how kids stepped up, whether they disruption occurred before they stepped up, were we able to step them up from the same foster home they were in so that we'd have a better chance of stepping them down to the same foster home? Did we allow the foster parent-child relationship to deteriorate before we stepped these kids up to a higher level? Did we have to have a shelter placement while we searched for a higher level of placement for these kids? All of these types of things were considered during the looking at the discharge planning goal. And the program improvement plan issues initiative that impacted this area was the child and youth investment team and the systems of care. So having done all of that, we've only been doing it for a year. I will give you some of our outcomes that we had right now so far. Let me get back out of here. So in the child and family team meeting, from the first quarter to the fourth quarter, we saw our measures improve by 62.5%. Five being the maximum number of points they can get, the system was actually performing at 0.8 when we start to measure this area. And right now we're only performing at our last measure was at 1.3. But it represents a 62% increase, and we still believe these numbers are going up even further because in this first year we took these measurements, it was kind of like without penalty. But going into the next year, every quarter, agencies who perform below 70%, I think is the number, and overall goals will be placed on intake hold and can't receive intake until they get to this higher level. And so we expect to see now with the penalty phase of this kicking in, these numbers to continue to increase. In our contact protocols, you get a maximum of 15 points. The first quarter, we saw 4.6%, and in the fourth quarter, we saw 7.6 of these contacts being made. So we really went from about a third of the required contacts being met to over half of the contacts being met. And that was about a 65% improvement in those areas. In planned and unplanned discharge, our discharge protocol, we saw improvement in those areas as well. This last quarter, we saw a little slippage back, but I think that's about how we looked at the data. But even with that slippage in the fourth quarter from the third quarter, we still saw a 52% improvement. And at a high, In the third quarter, with a possible 5 points, the system averaged 4.5 points. So it was about a 90% of the discharge planning was being done according to policy and what we had laid out. The other one looks at the permanency outcomes. And the permanency, we saw the first quarter at 21%. Second quarter shoot up to 31%, third quarter to 26%, next quarter shot up to 33%. But what was important about the permanency thing was that we saw no slippage in our permanency performance because there was concerns that if you start to focus on these other things, permanency would slip. And the way that first quarter to the fourth quarter plays out is the way the system has always performed around poor permanencies. You know, we get more kids home in December, and then another push seems like we get more kids home in June right when school lets out. And so the thing to point out here is that there was no reduction in the permanency performance by shifting the focus to some of these other goals. And stability, we're still up and down, but within a very tight range. And I think, if I remember correctly, in our eighth quarter of our PIP, I think we've met our PIP goal for stability outcomes, but we had some conflicts in how one set of data compared to the other, and we're trying to clean that up. And so with that's where I stop there. I'll just say that, you know, we have to look at performance-based contracting as a fluid process and not a static process. and you have to be setting goals, reassessing goals, and always redefining what the goals are, and always remembering that it's a requirement to set the stage to achieve that performance or to achieve those goals. That sometimes there are big system things that need to be done to put the system in better shape to be able to reach out to have those improved outcomes. And I think we're going to see, we've only been doing this expanded thing for a year, but I think we're going to see a lot greater improvements in this up and coming year, just reflecting on the amount of improvement we made in this first year. Mary,
that's
I think
great.
I'm done now.
That's great. Thanks. Thank you very much, Ms. McEwen. That's great. Why don't we take a few questions at this point? Are there people out there with who have questions for Illinois?
Hi, we're from New Hampshire. I have a question for you. I understand that in Illinois you have child welfare agencies that are both public and private. How does this contract measure work for the public side as well as the private side?
It works the same. Mostly we included this on the 80% of the foster care kids who are in the private sector. Even though we took these measures on the public sector, which does case management services on 20% of the kids, historically we've learned that it's hard to have that same impact. So we kind of use them as quality assurance measures more on the internal side, because it's not the same as where you can reduce a contract or put a contract on intake hold. We can put the public sector on intake hold, but the union is not going to allow us to reduce our staffing. I'm sorry to say that. So,
well, you start my question.
So we kind of use it more as a quality assurance measure in the public sector and give the supervisors some insight into how their team is performing and how to push toward these goals. And so you still seem to be getting some pretty good results in the public sector as well, but it's not that penalty phase and that incentive for improvement are different.
Could you expound a little bit about your service providers? They must have a relationship with your child welfare agencies, and how has outcomes affected, say, just a shelter care program?
A lot of times these child welfare agencies that we contract with show they also are the providers of those other support services as well. So when you're talking about a system with so many 100-year institutional agencies and 75-year institutional agencies, we're just talking about placement services here in foster care. But these same group of private providers also provide residential care, group care, counseling services. In fact, the department provides no residential care, group care, or spec foster care at all. And then there's the counseling services that they also provide. And we redesign our shelter system as a result of this because it kind of like helps kids to get placed on the front end more quickly because of the intake system that's attached to this mechanism. When I talk about the referrals of intakes early on, and that they have a guaranteed number of intakes and an intake. Now they don't have a guaranteed number of intakes, but they do have an intake goal and or a referral goal. It kind of does impact those other services.
I see. Thank you very much.
Right. And foster care is more of a foundational services, and most of those other services are support services to help foster care, like stabilization services, shelter care services, counseling services, those sort of things.
Okay, are there other questions out there?
Yes. This is Tennessee, and this may be a stupid question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Did you do your performance-based contracting only with foster care?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
We started out with just foster care. As a matter of fact, right now we're starting to examine moving it into residential care and independent living and transitional living services this year. I think to focus in on an area and to focus in on foster care was chosen because the largest percentage of kids in care are in just traditional and relative foster care. And so this impacts about 75% of the kids, 75 to 80% of the total population in care just by focusing on foster care. And to get some indication that it works and is working before you start to move it into other areas of care. That's kind of the approach we're taking. And so now we're looking at moving it into other areas of care. And I have to also go back and say, we weren't that planful and thoughtful. Really, you know, when we first focused on permanency, the real idea was to reduce the number of kids in care. And we thought we could do that, and we went after that. But all of those unintended negative consequences are exactly that. They were not intended. They were not planned for. And so the way we wind up doing things in two phases was not done at the beginning, but was something that happened naturally out of hindsight. But I would encourage other states or other individuals looking at this to take advantage of that and say, we need to think about these issues more on the front end. And then moving it into wider ranges of care, to me, seems to be the third phase. So the third phase of Illinois' performance contracting will be moving it into residential care, group care, and independent living and transitional living services. Now, whether you do all four of those categories at one time or you take a couple of them first, we haven't decided that, but we're working on trying to pull together a demonstration project right now.
This is Tennessee.
Yes.
Do you have any number dealing with your recidivism?
The only thing I can say about recidivism is our repeat maltreatment numbers are pretty good, and our reentry numbers are pretty good from the Child and Family Services review. And so I don't see us having a high level of that. And the shift is, though, is that you have more kids in that category. So our disruption rate for adoption is pretty much level. It's pretty much the same. But, say, instead of having 10 kids in adopted category, we now have 100 kids in the adoption category. So that raw number is higher. But the disruption rate as a percentage of the population has not changed. So, and these are pretty stable adoptions and those sort of things. And because a lot of times those kids have sat in those homes a very long time.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, this is EC, and I have a question. Can you speak a little bit about, in terms of the data that you're using for the indicators, that you're collecting from, I guess, the private agencies. Can you speak a little bit about how you're, one, are they actually entering it into your SACWIS system directly, and then how are you actually monitoring the private agencies?
Right. No, we're not entering into our SACWIS system directly. It's a completely separate system. And it's a database that we design in-house. And the way we're doing that monitoring is it stems from the first phase, the first redesign of the public-private relationship, where we have a what we call agency performance team monitor assigned to every agency. And so these monitors have about two or three agencies apiece that they monitor. And we created data collection protocols that are case record review-based, that they go out and they review the case record. But they're able to review a larger group of records because they only review the specific portion of the record that relates to the indicator they're looking for. So we have a contact protocol that we use. We have a child and family team meeting protocol that we use. We have a planned and unplanned discharge protocol that we use. We have an integrated assessment protocol that we use. The other indicators come from our old established performance-based contracting thing that looks at both permanency and stability. So it's actually they go out and they review these case records and they enter the data off the protocols into a database. Each worker enters that information. And then we're able to query the database to get these results, and we're able to rank the agencies. I thought about sending a ranking report to Mary, but then I didn't want to embarrass any of my private providers who may be listed on that ranking report. That's why I didn't send it out. But maybe I'll figure out a way to send out a ranking report that won't have any names on it, and you'll get an idea of how the database takes this information and spits out a ranking report for these agencies. And they rank them from top to bottom in these performance indicators and what percentage of the total points they were able to get.
This, Mary O'Brien, just to follow up, so the ranking, it consolidates the results from the case record reviews and the protocols that got put into a database, and also some data sources that are used for monitoring the permanency and the stability?
Right. It pulls from all five of those areas, plus education now. It'll pull from education and compiles the data and compiles the ranking report.
Okay. Great, thank you.
This is Jeff Prather in Alaska, and our system is so totally different than yours that I'm trying to back up just a second and try to make sure I understand what you're doing. So it sounds like for permanency at least, and I guess for once a child comes into state custody, 80% of those youth are then contracted out to private nonprofits. Is that right?
Yes.
And the information that they gather doesn't go into SACWITS, but you have another system, and the feds are okay with that, and they're okay with what you set up as far as the CFSR?
Yeah, the SACWITS system is the SACWITS system. That's the case record information all of this. The performance of the agencies is not a requirement in SACWITS. So all of these agencies are on SACWITS systems, and all of these agencies are entering the case record data into SACWIS.
Okay.
Now, this is just a pure performance contracting mechanism. It's not a record information. That's why I say when we go in there, we're measuring processes. The only way you can – the reason we were able to do the processing is because we have our PIP thing where every quarter we do an outcome enhancement review, which is basically a mini CFSR that we do each quarter so that we can start to see if this is actually impacting our PIP goals.
Okay,
but this is a separate thing that's looking at performance contracting. This is separate from the documentation that's entered into SACWIS.
Got it. Okay.
Right. And this is Mary O'Brien. Just to follow up on that, Mr. McEwen, so just comment on that idea of the broader quality improvement effort structure within your agency and how that's in place and that supports what you're doing with your performance contracting and the outcomes in the contracts. You mentioned these outcome enhancement reviews. So my sense is that it's important to have a broader quality improvement system that is supporting the and sort of focusing on some of the same outcomes that you're focusing on in your contract.
At the ground level, it's extremely important to have the outcome enhancement reviews because, you know, who's to say that somebody won't just, I know we don't have any providers in Illinois that would do this, but who's to say that somebody just not create documentation and stuff it in the file? So you have to really guard against that. And what the outcome enhancement review means is that we're going to pull case records on a random basis, and we're going to interview the foster parents, the biological parents, the kid, and all of those things. And if we compare the outcome enhancement review case review with the case that was reviewed utilizing the protocol, and they don't agree, so that, oh, we documented that this parent is visiting their child every week. But in the outcome enhancement review, their parents say, I haven't seen my kid for months. You know, so you have to have that sort of checks and balance to make sure that you're keeping people honest. And then the other piece to that is that when you're doing these protocols, you're just checking to see, did they have a visit? When you're doing the outcome enhancement review, you're taking a more qualitative look at that visit. So you're spending a lot more investment and time to look at 50 cases to kind of check again. I think we looked at almost 4,000 or 5,000 different cases on each protocol.
Right.
Yeah. So
okay,
you do
great.
Have to have that checks and balance there.
Thank you. This is Mary O'Brien again. Let's let's try to broaden this discussion a little bit and hear from some other states. Alaska, you just mentioned how, you know, Illinois has a very, you know, sort of unique system that every state does, but, you know, that there's a certain approach with the you know, a lot of contractor providers. I think the lessons from Illinois that are very important are this idea of setting the stage, that the agency takes steps, sort of these overall overarching strategies Mr. McEwen talked about in their PIP that is supporting the performance that's put into the contracts, that it needs to be, that the agency needs to take some broader steps and sort of set the stage for performance. That's a really important, I think, lesson in what they've done. And then also the fact of the need for sort of a broader set of sort of outcomes to monitor performance. So rather than just focusing on permanency, maybe having a broader set of you know, outcomes that go across the board and are more comprehensive. I think those are two lessons that can be applied in different places, you know, but everybody has a unique situation. So I thought we could hear if there's people out there who've had some positive experience with sort of setting outcomes in contracts or and monitoring those, that we could try to, you know, hear from them. And I know there are some folks from Kansas, and I asked them if they could maybe say a few words about their experience there in Kansas with, you know, having outcomes in their contracts and monitoring them. Are you guys out there still?
Yes. Yes, this is Patty from Kansas, and we've had outcomes in our contracts for family preservation, foster care and reintegration, and adoption services. We started in 1996, and you can see a difference in our contracts since then. We've gotten a lot better at writing the outcomes, and we think that is shown in the contracts. We are focusing a little bit more on the contract requirements now, and we focus a lot on the visits between worker child and the family and the child, and the early intervention with staff with the family to develop the to begin developing the case plan. We have an initial meeting within 24 hours and just kind of jumping right in and addressing the issues. And those are a lot of the contract requirements. We do have the overall contract outcomes with our providers, and I'm not quite sure what you would want to know about them. We monitor the contract outcomes by provider. We have 5 providers for foster care and reintegration. We have 5 providers statewide for family preservation. And the family preservation providers keep the same families and serve them even when they're out of home. And then we have 1 statewide adoption contractor, but the adoption contractor is to provide services to the other 2 contractors. The other contractors keep the cases for the entire life of the case. When I hear comments about there can be sanctions about no more referrals until something is up to par, we don't have that because our requirements are that all referrals in a specific geographic region will go to that contractor, and they must accept them and they must work with them. So that's kind of a little different. We do a lot of monitoring on case reads, looking at actual case activity, and that's really helpful in looking at when outcomes aren't being met and how to set outcomes and things like that. That's about all I have.
Great, great. This is Mary O'Brien. Do you feel like were the providers open to having a comprehensive set of outcomes? I mean, are you looking at both the sort of permanency, safety, and well-being, kind of a mix of those outcomes in your sets of outcomes for those providers?
Oh, definitely. They're definitely a lot of our outcomes that are, you know, consistent with the federal outcomes. We have a few additional outcomes that we wanted for contract purposes. But, their providers are very receptive to them, and they're very on board with our upcoming CFSR review. And then we think of the contracts just put us really in place for that, really in everything's in alignment.
Mm-hmm.
Question from Michigan. Can you tell us what your outcomes are?
I can email them. I don't think you'd want me to read them all.
Can you give us a general idea or 1 or 2 of them or something?
Well, they do focus on safety, permanency, and well-being, but there's kind of different parts in them.
Yes, and you know what I'm going to say? I I mentioned earlier that I have this packet of information about performance-based contracting that I can provide to people, and I have in there, Patty, the link for your Kansas website that has the sets of outcome measures for the different contracts.
Okay.
You know? So that might be helpful if people are interested in looking at that. I'm going to say that there's an evaluation form for this teleconference that's both, you know, attached to the email that you got with the handouts, and it's also on our website. I was going to mention it at the end. If you want to just note on there, you know, could you please send me this packet, then I'll email it to you.
Hi. Okay. This is Michigan. I just have a question for anybody out there that has outcomes established. We have performance outcomes in our placement agency foster care contracts and in our residential foster care contracts. And we just really, we've had them in there all along, but really with this last contracting cycle, put them in to establish, to get a baseline established for our next round of contracts. And that's when we are going to expect people to achieve a certain level of performance. But, you know, when you ask the question or somebody asked the question about how receptive the private agencies were to establishing those performance outcomes, ours are fine with sitting down and, you know, coming up with the outcomes, but when it gets to the next step of, you know, some form of accountability or maybe incentive or disincentive when they achieve or don't achieve, that's when things get dicey. And I just wondered in Kansas or in Illinois, have you had to take action or disincentives? I know that you might stop referrals, but what are the consequences for lack of achieving outcomes, and how successful has that been?
We've had a number of agencies that we've discontinued contracting with. I think initially there were about 60, high 60s of agencies who had foster care contracts, and we're down to about 38. And so you're going to have to pare down your system in number of providers because you're reducing the number of kids. So if you reduce the number of kids, in our case, from 52,000 to 16,600, then you also don't need as many providers to care for 16,600 kids as you needed to care for 52,000 kids. So this really is a way to pare down your providers, but make sure that you're keeping the quality providers and shifting those other providers who are not doing a quality job out. And so, yes, and it did create a lot of problems, a lot of struggles. It's not an easy process. But I think it was something needed that you make sure that you keep the right providers as you're reducing the number of kids in care.
Right. Mr. McEwen, if you are aiming to right-size your system as you were, if you have too many children in out-of-home care and want to reduce that number, then you are going to be reducing the number of providers. But can you talk about, and I think maybe other places have experience with this, another approach I think that some places have taken is encouraging agencies to redesign or restructure what they're offering, that they can diversify and begin to offer more in-home kind of services so that they can meet the needs of kids who are maybe going to be staying home or going home earlier, and they sort of basically re-engineer and have the agency help them in that process.
Right. Yeah. And it's important to note that we didn't close these providers. We reduced the number of them that held this contract, and
right.
Some of them held other services. So as you create the system of care services, that's another service area. You know, so as you develop these other areas, you're right, that you do create other service needs to support these foster care placements.
That they could contract for.
Yes, they could contract for. But I would still say that, you know, the quality indications are there, and so there's always that struggle of if they're unable to provide quality foster care, can they provide quality foster care supports? So I really would have to say some agencies couldn't, so that some agencies did wind up going out of business. But what I can say is that I do believe we have a more quality system now, and the providers that we are utilizing are delivering a quality service that needs a lot more improvement.
Right. with the person from Michigan, this is Mary O'Brien, would you say, I think what people in other places tend to feel, Mr. McEwen, or often feel, is that there isn't enough of an array of providers that they can afford to have contract, not to no longer contract with some providers. I mean, I think that's what people, some people in other parts of the country experience, you know, rather than in heavily urban areas. I don't know if you've noticed that in rural areas, or has anybody else had any experience with that?
In rural areas is a struggle, and that was one of the findings in our Child and Family Services review, is that our service array gaps, we had service array gap issues, and that was a huge struggle. That was one of the only systemic issues we didn't pass. The other six, I think, of the seven we did pass. And so there is a service array issue when you get to some of the rural and non-urban communities. And in those areas, what you try to do is contract with those providers that remain to try to build up those areas. But that's a huge struggle, especially since we are using that SAID, Child and Youth Investment Team, and we're using the integrated assessment to do this assessment on the front end. We're really running into some struggles there because we're exposing our service array gap because we're doing a better job of identifying needs.
Right.
This is Kansas again, and we don't have the choice, you know, all the different providers in one region. Like, we have one reintegration and foster care provider in each of the five regions in our state, but we've tried to cover that by the contract requirements of providing all the services that the family needs, and we've really encouraged and now monitor the partnership agreements that they have with different providers in their communities. And those can change at that level. So it's kind of still there, but it's not where we have a choice. It's where our main providers have a choice of who their partnership agreements are with.
Explain that a little bit. This is Mary O'Brien. What do you mean by partnership agreements and monitoring them?
We monitor our main providers of who they have partnership agreements with. Is it the local mental health center? Things like that. What local providers?
Are they sort of accessing into their network the whole array of services that are in the community?
Yes, it's a way to look at, are they doing that? And they have the option of, you know, different using different providers in their communities. But we, that's kind of how we've managed that here, because we don't have a choice of different main providers. We have one for each service in each geographic region.
So what, now to follow up on Michigan's question earlier about accountability, what do you find if they're not performing well in a certain area? I mean, have you, in a certain region of the state or a certain provider, how have you found you can put some pressure on them in terms of accountability?
What we've tried to do is the constant monitoring of the different contract requirements of the outcomes, the publication of the outcomes.
Right.
A lot of information is on our website. We try to pull everything together in the annual, administrative monitoring reports. We pull in customer service issues. Obviously, there's no names in it, but we talk about responsiveness to inquiries and things like that. We pull in case read information. Anything that's going on, we pull into the administrative monitoring reports. And I know those have been used in the past by our providers to seek any other funding that they want to use, kind of a grade card, so to speak, of their services.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of rely on it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Does anybody else out there from other places have a comment on Michigan's question about accountability, or an experience, a positive experience they want to share about negotiating some outcomes into their contracts and monitoring them? This is Mary O'Brien. Like you can see, it's hard to do, right? let me just say that I, as preparing for this call, I've come across a couple of other things that I thought I would tell you about. Wisconsin has just shared with me an example of their special needs adoption contracts, and I was impressed at that, and they've had a really good experience with working with their adoption providers and building some performance standards into their contracts, and they have a 10% holdback provision where they hold back 10% of the total payment until the agencies demonstrate that they've met these provisions, these performance expectations, and then they can get that additional 10% payment. And they started for a number of years using just a satisfaction survey with their adoptive parents in the special needs adoption program. But now they've modified it so 25% of the performance ranking comes from this performance on the satisfaction survey. And another 25% is on staffing issues, on stability of staffing issues within the agency. And then there's a whole other 50% that they use around process kinds of things, like the agencies are getting 4E documentation work done and entering the data into the system that they need to use, and that they're making the data files available to the agency and things like this, and more process kind of measures. So I'm going to add that Wisconsin contract to this packet, if people are interested in seeing it. But it's an example of a place that has had some success with putting outcomes into their contracts and monitoring them. Is anybody from Massachusetts on the line? No? Okay. That was somebody was registered from there, and they've had some interesting experience there with their family networks projects. And I know that somebody from there who's going to be on the call had let me know that they're beginning to ask their lead agencies to track engagement with families, school placement issues, and length of stay. So I think it's very much like, to get back to what Mr. McEwen said about the three tiers of the kinds of measures you can use. I think a lot of places like Massachusetts are looking at a combination of a sort of more solid outcome kind of measure around permanency, like the length of stay issues, maybe putting in there stability or safety kind of issues too, but then putting that together with a process issue like engaging families, having family team meetings, having the visits with families, and then you mentioned, Mr. McEwen, efforts, and that's one I don't see very often, but it's on that tier. Does anyone else out there have questions?
This is Nebraska, and I have a question for maybe the future, if any other state has some answers they can email me or something, but we're a little different, and we do very little contracting out or privatization of case management, and we are more interested in anyone that's doing any kind of outcome-based or performance-based contracting for specific services. As a state, we contract for different types of services to provide to families, and our caseworkers make referrals to those providers for different things, and so we're struggling with doing performance based on, or measuring performance based on, for individual contracts. So if anyone has anything, I'd be more than happy to hear from you.
This is Mary Brown. Individual contracts include like residential care and foster care? Is that included, or are you thinking of things more like, counseling services or?
I'm thinking of things more like what we would call family support services. It would be group home care, non-treatment services. Group home care, not foster care. We have different, we have visitation services. We contract out for those, that kind of thing.
Right. Okay. Does anybody have any comments on that? I get that question about, outcomes-focused contracts for more of these support services, specific services, and I would like to know more about it, too. Okay, if anybody does have anything to share, you could maybe let me know through the evaluation form as well. Does anybody have any other questions for Illinois or for Kansas or for any of the other states that have shared their experience with us?
New Hampshire again. I have one for Mr. McEwen.
Yes.
It's a curiosity question. In the handout, we talked about going from, and I think Mr. McEwen talked about the system dropping from 52,000 down to 16. And the people who were left behind were some of the more difficult, needy, older. And yet I see that the percentages for success have gone up each year. Those two just seem to be conflicting concepts.
The percentages for success?
Yes.
Percentages for success of what?
Well, when you were talking about your overall percentage, and I think on the first page of your handout, you talked about beginning caseloads started at 24%. Now they're being combined. They went up to 33%. Now they're being combined to 29%.
Right. So what you're looking at is over years. So in 24% was in 1997. And then you're moving up in years to finally being at 29% when we combine both contracts. But actually, at its highest point, the performance goal was 33%. So that 29%, when you combine in these contracts, is actually a reduction from the original goal. So,
okay, and that's how you've factored in that there's lesser kids in the system, they're more difficult in their needs, and that they're older?
No, that's not how we factored in that. That's what you're asking about, how could we show continued improvement in permanency if we had those kids getting older. The way we factored in that was to look at the planned and unplanned discharge performance, because that's looking at those older kids.
I see. Okay.
And then you're looking at the engagement and the contact, because that's looking at how often we contact those older kids.
Oh, I forgot that originally you only had two markers, the permanency and the placement stability.
Exactly. And that's where, you know, when the Child and Family Services review looked at it, it looked at it and said, hey, you got all of these older kids that, so great, you get all of these permanencies, but what about those kids?
I get it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. McEwen, this is Mary O'Brien. We've had a series of calls over the last 2 years on this topic around getting providers on board around outcomes. And I wanted to ask you, 2 years ago we had a call with the folks from Illinois, including yourself, and some people from Kansas, talking about getting providers on board and doing outcomes-focused contracting. And both of you talked about then about the importance of working collaboratively with providers, moving towards more of a relational kind of model of really working with your providers collaboratively. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that in the work that you've done over the years with performance-based contracting and sort of how you've worked with your providers, like what kind of processes you've used to involve them in a kind of cooperative effort.
Right. Well, actually, our legislators created it, the Child Welfare Advisory Committee. And what we've done is use that committee to start to set the stage as the body in which the collaboration is done between the public and private sector. As much as you can call it a collaboration when you consider the relationship between contractor and contractee. And so through that Child Welfare Advisory Committee, we have several different subcommittees, foster care infrastructure, high-end treatment, old award subcommittee. It's about four or five of them. And then those subcommittees have subcommittees. And what happens is that you have this functioning body that has standing meeting dates. The CWAC itself meets every quarter. So that in a way that it keeps the vehicle open for the private agency input on all issues, because everything that comes up is going to land in CWAC, the Child Welfare Advisory Committee, and it's going to land on one of those subcommittee tables, so that somebody is continuously working on these issues. And what it does is it reduces the frustration level of the providers in the department, because when an issue arises, there's no need to feel strained, like we got to call a meeting, we got to address this real quickly. It's just a matter of getting it on the agenda for the next meeting.
Mm-hmm.
which is a much simpler process than, and that way it's always, that's when I'm talking about the fluid nature of the process has got to be there. And those type of mechanisms have got to be built in because there's a certain amount of tension when issues are arising and there's no place to then discuss or raise these issues.
Exactly. So a regular sort of collaborative organized effort is really valuable.
Right. And it should be ongoing in nature to really work well.
Yep. Great. Thank you. The other thing that was mentioned in the call 2 years ago was the importance of data. And you mentioned that, Mr. McEwen, about the importance of having reliable, valid data that everybody could agree on. And that's often a real challenge with performance-based contracting. And one of the ways you addressed it was having an external university-based group that had some research-based data that everybody could agree on. So that was a valuable resource that you had. Can you just comment a little bit on the importance of the data?
Yeah. When agencies' contracts and all of those things are based on outcome and evaluation, data becomes a huge issue, and the quality of data becomes a huge issue. It was really fortunate in Illinois that we had Chapin Hall here, which had been collecting human services data from all over the country, and particularly, too, data from Illinois that we can go back and use. But I think all states have university groups and those sort of things. So it's real important that you also work on developing your university partners. You know, this is just me. I've learned that I'm way too passionate about social work. And the 10% of the troubled cases will shape my opinion for the whole 90%. And you may come up with things that are far too restrictive for the 90% based on the 10% that's always confronting you with challenges. So I've really come, especially in the role with the department, to rely on data, to tone down those passions and try to get a grip on what's reality, you know, versus my perception. And
absolutely,
I think data is real important.
That's great. That's great. Okay, well, we are nearing the end time here. I think we're right there. So I'm gonna wrap this up, okay? So thank you. I want to first of all say thank you to Mr. McEwen, Erwin McEwen from Illinois, for coming. Thank you very much for sharing your experience with us. That was really great. And thank you, everyone on the line, for your questions and comments. And I hope that you found this useful. We do have an evaluation of the call, and we're always using those to help shape our teleconferences. As I mentioned, there's an evaluation form that was attached to the email that you got that you can fill out and email into us. And there's also an evaluation form at our website that you can fill out. The website is, again, www.nrcoi.org. So we'd be really happy to get your feedback, and I hope you'll do that for us. Thank you again, everyone, for coming, and we hope to talk to you again in the future. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. You may now disconnect and have a great day.